From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 577, The Practice of Systems and Network Administration, with guest Tom Limoncelli. Recorded Tuesday, February 13th, 2018. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Tom Limoncelli, who's a published author, DevOps pundit, and system administrator. He is the manager of Site Reliability Engineering Team at StackOverflow.com, a wonderful place in New York City. He's previously worked at Google, Bell Labs, and other companies, and along with Christina Hogan and Strata Chalup, is the co-author of The Practice of System and Network Administration, The Practice of Cloud System Administration, and Time Management for System Administrators. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
No. And on other shows, we oddly enough reference Stack Overflow, Stack Exchange, server fault. So thanks for keeping up a system that helps an awful lot of us find answers to hard questions.
Sure. It's my pleasure. Yeah, I've been here about 5 years. And when I interviewed, it was just really exciting to be at the office of the website that I use so much.
Yeah, that's very powerful. And before we go diving off into the books, I want to read this comment from a listener. This is off of a show 546, August of 2017, when we were talking about, I was talking to Ned Pyle about turning off SMB1. You know, one of those classic networking tools, and just this fact that, you know, SMB1 has fundamentally got security problems. It's a 30-year-old protocol. It's been exploited left, right, and center, and you just got to get it turned on. Of course, Ned's actually responsible for it inside of Microsoft, and so he's pushing to have Windows simply not allow it to run at all. But, you know, WannaCry and things like that have made it even more acute. And this comment comes from Johan Siprich, who said, "Hi, Ned, I have a client that's running a web application that will only run on .NET 2.0 and Windows 2000. Ugh, 18-year-old tech. There is no possibility of upgrading anything here. The software developers have long since upgraded their product to a SaaS model, which my client would not want to utilize. Their customers will likely be using this app for the next 10 years. The old hardware for it was eliminated using Hyper-V on Windows 2008. And so SMB1 is going to be a problem for at least the next decade. While it's not realistic to make these technologies 100% secure, is there anything you've done to minimize the security risks?" And Ned responded to Johan at the time and just said, look, it's about narrowing down the scope of access for SMB1. Minimal number of nodes that can do those communications, keep the conversation inside some IPsec tunnels if at all possible, so no man-in-the-middle attacks, air gap wherever possible, just try and lock it down. It's an interesting problem, and I just appreciate as we're having a conversation about being a network professional, this is reality that, you know, what Johan's describing is not an exceptional case. Yeah, SMB1 should be banished, but given that you're not going to take that functionality away from customers, how do you protect yourself? So, Johan, thank you so much for your comment. A Run As Radio mug is on its way to you, and if you'd like a Run As Radio mug, write a comment on the website at runasradio.com or via any of our social media, because every show is published to Google+, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And if you comment there and we read it on the show, we'll send you a mug. So, Tom, that's what's going on and out in the, my world. Do you agree with that sort of sentiment that, like, I know you want rid of SMB1, you're just not always possible?
I agree. Part of the essence of being a system administrator is you're always dealing with new technologies and getting rid of the old technologies. I like to put two things in place when I'm dealing with technologies. One is I try to limit the number of versions in the environment. So, for example, I was at a company once that had, you know, every version of Windows back to Windows 95 somewhere in their network. And I said, okay,
oh my goodness,
we need to establish, you know, a version limit. You know, let's say we're going to have three versions of Windows and we're not going to introduce the fourth until we've eliminated the one at the tail of the list, right?
Yeah, the eldest one.
Eldest, exactly. And that took management discipline, which brings me to my other technique, which I call ratcheting. You know, a ratchet in your toolbox, it's that device that it only turns one direction.
Right.
Right. And so you have to say, like, okay, if we're getting rid of a technology, step A is no new projects can use that technology. And part two is we have to be always working towards eliminating the current uses of it. I'm a big fan of checklists. And so like with SMB version one, you know, I would have a wiki page or a Google Doc or a spreadsheet or something that says, you know, these are the known customers that are depending on this and why are they depending on it? And you know, whether we try to eliminate one per month or one per quarter, you know, eventually we're going to get there. And often just talking to the people, they say, oh, we didn't know, you know, this little flag would switch us to SMB2 or,
right.
Or, oh, we have some, we're communicating to a satellite in space that can't be upgraded. And, but the satellite's batteries run out.
Yeah. This is just going to have to be dealt with for a while.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned the list because in that show with Ned, you know, back in August of last year, he maintains a page on the storage blog that is, he calls it the SMB1 product clearinghouse. Mm-hmm. And it's literally a list of all the products out there still depending on SMB1. I don't want to call it a list of shame, but you know, now it feels to me like in your thinking about the checklist is like, okay, well, before we acquire a product, knowing SMB1's an issue for us, go check this list, make sure that product's not on that list.
Right. And while I also don't like to call it a list of shame, shame is a very powerful motivator. I like to use it strategically and diplomatically. But you know, related to that, if that dependency is outside, it's a vendor or another company, mm-hmm. One thing I add in my list is the bug ID with that company that's tracking the issue.
Right.
And I often find technical people say, oh, they know it's a problem. And I say, well, is there a bug ID or you know a ticket number? And they know it's a problem. You know, bug ID or it didn't happen, right?
Yeah, right. Or you're not serious.
Right.
Right. Show me the evidence that you guys have a plan that's going to make this end.
Right.
And I think that's very fair. We're not asking anybody to do things immediately. I mean, that's just not realistic. But it's like, at least put it on the list so that we can prioritize it. We can explain where it's at. And when the opportunities to move on it, you do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's just an interesting set of disciplines all around this. And this is just one of many facets. When you define the role of network administration, what do you describe it as?
You know, that's one of the biggest problems in IT is the role of network administrator or system administrator is so ill-defined. Mm-hmm. And this actually hurts our careers.
I totally agree.
I've met people who say that at my company, if it has an electrical plug, I'm responsible for it. And wow. It's really, if the microwave oven in the kitchen breaks, and I've had people say, 2 weeks ago, me and the office manager went to a store to buy a new microwave because, yes.
I'm a professional.
And that's great that you're all inclusive, but I think it dilutes our recognition of what we do. One of the interesting things about DevOps is it's provided this career reset. Like you say, okay, you know, as DevOps engineer, I'm in charge of the CI system and mm-hmm. the deployment system and the on-call. And that's a really well-defined thing that we can, you know, sink our teeth into and focus on. And when you have a more focused definition of your job, it actually leads to you being more valued and better paid in sure. the company, which is ironic because you would think, but I have 50 million skills and I can replace a microwave oven. Isn't that more valuable? Well, weirdly enough, that's not how business works.
Yeah, I agree. That being focused in on areas that are acknowledged as important within the organization, rather than being a generalist, makes you more valuable.
Yeah, you want to be the go-to person in one thing. It's more valuable than being the generalist.
Yeah, I totally agree. But the other problem, of course, is that don't be the specialist in the thing that they can outsource or that ends up being plumbing. It's just not important anymore. Like you don't really want to be a specialist in electrical outlets.
Right.
That's not that valuable for most organizations. It just comes with the building.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, and it makes me wonder if networking is there, that, you know, how much of networking is still salient specific skills that an individual company needs to cultivate.
Yeah. Especially since over time, things have gotten more and more cookie cutter, and I don't like to use the word outsource because it can mean so many things,
sure.
but delegatable to other things. Mm-hmm. You know, my first job out of college as a system administrator, I thought my boss was an amazing system administrator because he could build an Ethernet cable. You know, he took the raw wire, he crimped on the RJ45 ends, And he could crimp and get it right on the first try. And it took me like 3 or 4 tries to get it right every time. And that was what a skilled system administrator did. And 25 years later, who would make their own Ethernet cable? No, you buy them off the shelf.
Yeah, why would you take the risk that you get it wrong?
Right. And in fact, for many people, why would you connect a cable, right? You would just tell, you know, AWS or Azure or Google Cloud to connect this machine to that machine. And that's how you network up your machines.
Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like today, for sure.
Yeah. So it's gone from like a kit to let someone else do it to it's virtual and it's an API call. And I think everything's going that way. That happened to storage. That happened, you know, with SANs, and that happens with CPUs and everything. And it's becoming more and more important for system administrators to be able to code for that reason.
Yeah, that's a very interesting conversation, which I've been having steadily all this month for some reason. The shows I've been doing have been a lot about that. Hey, you know, we're all kind of developers these days. It's just a question of what code you write. And it's very interesting to think about that software-defined networking mindset, that you know, just part of the deployment script of an app is defining the whole network as well.
Yeah, yeah. If I can ask you a question, you know, I'm trying to find out what's the universal rite of passage for system administrators, because when I was getting started, it was to set up an email server,
right?
Because to do that, you had to know how to install an operating system, set up DNS, learn enough of the email protocols, and usually a server and a client, and do all those things. And every system administrator I knew, like, that was their big project. And when they did that, they felt, now I'm a real system administrator. Right. And now no one does that.
No, in fact, it's a mistake to do it, right?
Right.
You actually did this rite of passage, now turn it off, because we don't do that anymore.
Right, right. There's no benefit to running your own email server anymore. No. But I don't know what the new rite of passage is.
You know, it's funny, you know, you have a creation vision around that. It shows how cynical I am, that my immediate thought when you said mail is getting a broken mail server back up and running again with everybody screaming at you. I ran an Exchange server for the longest times because I loved my ability to look an Exchange server administrator in the eye and say, I feel your pain. Mm-hmm. Because it is an expected resource now, right? People cannot abide their mail being down. And so the tension that exists in keeping what is considered a commodity product operating all the time, it's very costly to your mind. And surviving that is a remarkable rite of passage.
Yeah, yeah.
And represents why you push it to the cloud. Stop caring for that yourself, right? Everything I can do that eliminates my need to have a pager because people can't tolerate it laying down for even a minute is, you know, part of that pain. I don't know what the contemporary creation equivalent is anymore. I certainly think, and you talk about different aspects of sysadmin, there's the aspect of creating an onboarding script for a new employee. Mm-hmm. You know, getting away from Word and just a document and into this, now I type in the name and some specifications and things are made, right? That's a mailbox and an account profile and security contacts and a place in SharePoint and all of those things that go to onboarding a new employee. What do you think?
Yeah, I think in an office environment, that's a good example.
Yeah.
The nice thing about creating an email server is it's something you can do on the weekends in preparation for, you know, interviewing for a position.
Right. Something that demonstrates your particular skill.
Right.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Like, it used to be really cool to show, like, put on a resume that your email address was your own domain.
Yes. That was totally a style thing, right? That I own my domain. It's from myself. Totally. Exactly that issue. And Tom, give me one moment here for this very important announcement. Being a sysadmin is still fun, but you have to keep your skills both current and forward-facing. If only there was a training class that you could take that would enable you to do both. Wait, there is. Get trained on current and modern desktop management with group policy and mobile device management from MVP Jeremy Moskowitz of GPAnswers.com. Get online training, come to a public class with other IT admins, or host your own private class. Just don't leave managing those desktops to chance. Get desktop management handled with hundreds of real-world tips, tricks, best practices, and real lab examples for you and your team to take home and implement immediately. And if you're grounded in the now with group policy and flirting with mobile device management, the GPAnswers.com class explains it all. Get desktop management totally handled. Just go to GPAnswers.com and get the course outline and see if it's right for you. GPAnswers.com, where smart IT admins come to get smarter. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. Richard Campbell here talking to Tom Limoncelli, and we're talking about, you know, being a proper network administrator and sysadmin and what that really looks like these days in the modern practice. You've got a separate book that is specifically the practice of the cloud system administrator. But is there really any sysadmin roles now that don't involve at least some cloud?
Good point. We struggled coming up with a good title, and I'm not in love with the title because what I want the title to be is about five paragraphs of explaining what it is. But amazingly enough, my publisher wouldn't let me do that.
They won't go for that, huh?
They didn't. It's really a book about running cloud-based services.
Right.
But it's not like, well, you create an AWS account and you click on this and you do that. It's really more high level. It's like when you're running a service that has to be up 24/7, here's the operability that you need to design into it. And here's a common architectural patterns. And here's how to manage on call. And you're going to be dealing with developers that are going to use these terms like distributed databases. And so I explain a lot about those terms and stuff. It's really good interview prep for working at a company that does large, you know, applications like a Facebook or Google or something.
Sure. Also, a good list of these are the skills you need to cultivate to be competent in this particular space.
Yeah. It's very much the things I learned when I worked at Google and my co-authors, their experiences at similar companies. The practice of system and network administration, that's kind of everything that is more enterprise-y. It's from desktop support to PC administration. And that's gone through numerous revisions. We just released the third edition, which is almost a complete rewrite because the world is so different than 2001 when the first edition came out.
And this is a seriously beefy book. 1,200 pages? Holy man.
Yeah, it's way too long. Get the ebook.
Said the author. I love everything about that.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone's actually read the whole thing front to back, but the chapters are broken into different parts, usually about five or six chapters in each part. And each one could possibly be a standalone book.
Right.
And one thing that keeps happening when we write books, Christine and I have written a couple books together in Strata, and we have this pattern where we plan out the book, we write most of the chapters, and then at the very end, we think, oh, there's all these other things that we want to say. And we add those chapters to the front, and then we have to renumber all the chapters. And I'm kind of proud of the opening four chapters of this new edition, because we talk about the principles of DevOps without putting them in the traditional DevOps situation. So people think of DevOps as, oh, that's what big websites do to, you know, publish and upgrade websites without any downtime.
Right. Sort of software as a service mentality is DevOps.
Right. But everything in DevOps is really based on some core principles about doing things in small batches and doing things repeatably, and repeatability through documentation and automation and infrastructure as code. And we apply all those principles to your normal desktop support environment.
I love that. And just this idea that it doesn't have to be, we only do DevOps because we're writing original code with a team of developers, and operations is part of that flow. And I think we've talked about this previously on the show, this idea that any tech support request should be automatable, and that it's actually the support person that ends up writing the code or working with somebody to help them write the code to automate whatever that support request was, so that the next time that request comes in, it's solved in less time.
Exactly. And for that situation, my favorite programming language is English. The first version of the code can be a bullet list that says, I did this, this, this. And then the next time you do it, there's a little less thinking because you have that bullet list. And maybe you cut and paste the shell commands or the PowerShell commands that you use to do those things. So you go through these revisions where it's English, and then it's English with commands interspersed. And then the commands get a little better. Maybe you add some error checking. And maybe you never get to actually writing a program to do that thing.
Sure.
But now you're cutting and pasting these commands, and it not only makes it go faster, but it makes it more repeatable, or more importantly, less error prone.
Right. Reliable. Yeah. You're exactly right. You know, you talk about a core skill for an administrator. It's that assessing of time. It's like, this is a very easy thing I can do that will speed up the next time I do this. As opposed to, you know, going to a full automated script, and that's a lot more complexity. Like, you've got to be able to weigh, well, how often are we using this versus how much time it takes to create and maintain a thing to automate that, as opposed to, here is the six PowerShell commands I had to issue to solve this problem for this person.
Right.
Sitting in a note file that I can simply cut and paste my way through. It's like, okay, done. Thanks.
Exactly. And I didn't think of this until after the book came out, but I now call this PasteOps.
PasteOps. I love it.
Yeah. And because I've been in situations where, you know, the first bullet list item says, you know, set this variable, like username equals, you know, J. Smith, and then the other commands, now you really are just pasting them, because instead of phony names in it, it's, you've put in variable names.
Right.
And you really are doing paste ops. And for all these little things that are too small to automate, it paste ops is revolutionary.
Mm-hmm. No, a really good idea. And the simple enough bar, there's certainly going to be a complexity level where the script is better off compiled in a test harness. And the higher level of reliability, again, is it's one command that runs to a chunk of code that we all depend on.
Right.
But I do like that there's a gradation there that you can sort of go step by step. Do you run into folks that specialize on the networking side that just kind of avoid the whole DevOps mantra that I'm here to define VLANs and things, I don't need to be part of a DevOps practice?
Yes, absolutely. And for them, I say two things. One is, one of the principles of DevOps is have a test environment. Mm-hmm. Before you go into production. And I know a lot of people say, well, you know, my network infrastructure costs $500,000. I can't just clone it as a test environment. But there are so many little things you can do. You could have a test VLAN with similar firewall rules. Yep. That you test things there before you go into production. And the other thing is infrastructure as code.
Mm-hmm.
If half of your day is doing little port changes, you know, setting the VLAN or turning on a port, turning off a port, that kind of stuff really should be controlled by Puppet or a self-service portal where,
right,
I've seen systems that know that, you know, the port in my office is port 123, and I can change that one port, and alleviating the network administrators from having to do 90% of the work that is really the boring stuff.
Yeah.
And now you can focus on the cool stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, that's sort of the next stage, that sort of help desk progression. It's like, eventually it's like, how about you don't even call me anymore? Here's the self-service portal to get that thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it does make sense that we get there for certain repeating things. Again, the more times you do it, the more automation you really want to put around it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes I hear people say, well, if I automate my work, they won't need me anymore.
Yeah.
But it's actually the opposite. The amount of IT work that needs to be done at most companies is infinite.
Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever gotten to the bottom of the to-do list, ever.
Exactly. Yes. So get rid of the boring stuff.
Yeah.
And now, you know, those port assignments can happen even when you're, you know, on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And you can focus on the cool, new, interesting stuff.
But I also find that most organizations look at sysadmin networking, especially, as these necessary evils. They're like the janitor. You need to have them, otherwise the place is a mess, but minimize costs. They are only a cost center. They're not a value add or a capital investment for the organization.
Right. And that's another DevOps thing, is try to understand the business's revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
Or they call the value chain, which is, you know, be part of optimizing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes you valuable. That makes you go from IT as the necessary evil to IT as what's driving this company and making us win in the marketplace. So the classic DevOps example is, no matter what we do as a company, we might be selling auto parts or pizza. Fundamentally, what we do is, there's this cycle of, we have an idea, coders write the code, we test it, we put it into production, repeat. And we're doing this cycle over and over again.
Right.
And so the classic DevOps is, how can we do that better? How can we automate the deployment so that instead of doing it once every 3 months, the software is being upgraded every day or every week?
Mm-hmm. Every hour, even.
Right. Every hour. I mean, Etsy has that article about, they did 6,000 code pushes in 2014.
Wow.
And what that meant is, every time the developer basically committed code, it just kicked off this automated test process and then pushed it into production. So it was just continuously upgrading and improving their software. So what's the equivalent in, you know, outside of the software development world? One example is the onboarding process for new employees. I was at a company once, new employees were not productive until week 5 or 6 of employment. And they took a step back and said, what is our onboarding process? Where are the problems? They fixed the process. They automated not everything, but, you know, the difficult parts or whatever. And they did automate things like account creation and operating system installation. And soon people were being productive on their first or second day.
Right.
Now that's revenue.
Money. Yeah. Huge.
That's for a salesperson. Then they're selling on day one instead of day 40, or at least, you know, they're getting into training or whatever. And that made the IT department part of the revenue stream.
That's really interesting. That's a really interesting angle on it. Because an awful lot of good networking is also the security aspect of, until we have a breach and incur that cost, it's hard for you to value the thinking that a networking person has into granularizing security, limiting individual rights, all of those sorts of things. I think it's very challenging to understand the value there without having something bad happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you can be part of the value chain of making sure that vulnerabilities are detected and remediated quickly, I think of it as a conveyor belt through a factory. Mm-hmm. And like every time we turn the crank, a car company, every time it turns the crank, it produces a car.
Right.
Well, what does the IT organization produce? Well, I'm thinking of one specific friend, his IT team, really it's two conveyor belts. There's the one that every time they turn the crank, a new employee has access to everything they need. That's the onboarding crank. And then the other crank is supporting their work. So the help desk thing, tickets come in, get processed, get resolved.
Right.
And every time they turn the crank, a user is more productive. And so I try to think about that for like for networking and security, there's new vulnerabilities coming all the time. We need a machine where every time we turn the crank, the newly discovered vulnerabilities have been detected and software patches or whatever has been deployed to remediate those things.
Right. It's just, you know what? It's tough to measure that over time. You know, you realize once you've built that onboarding process, every single person you onboard thereafter, you've saved X many days of work.
Right.
Like, I do think it's very challenging to a year later say, can you still really measure that? You know, obviously, if we took it away, it would be a problem.
Right. But once you've turned it into a repeatable process and you start thinking, instead of thinking about every vulnerability as unique, you think about it as every vulnerability has the same beginning, middle, and end. Now you can start tracking it. And if you just open a ticket for every vulnerability, you can go back into your database and track, you know, last year tickets stayed open for 6 weeks. Now they stay open for 4 weeks.
Right.
And that's a lot better than just volume because you can eliminate your ticket counts by just
not checking things in as tickets.
Right.
And you can, if you want to up your rate of solve, create tickets for going to lunch. You know, like you don't want to put in metrics that create bad behavior. You do want to encourage the good behavior and measure things that are really quite relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
And the danger of how quickly a ticket is closed is you don't open it till you're ready to close it.
Sure, sure.
But it is, you know, not that, you know, you want people to do the right thing, but, and I firmly believe good people will still get decent results in a weak system, but a strong system where you don't have to be disciplined to still do the right thing is a better approach. It's just not always easy to craft.
Sure. My team at Stack Overflow is starting a project soon that kind of addresses that. We, rather than tickets, it's we have a vulnerability scanner that has good logs and will tell us when the vulnerability first appeared and when it was remediated, because it then goes off the dashboard. Mm-hmm. And so we can look at the logs and create those statistics based on something that can't be, I don't want to say doctored, but like you were saying before, where you just open the ticket right before you solve it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't be in a hurry to open the ticket, be in a hurry to close it. But yeah, you're right. It's easy for people to get into that tougher thing. But I also like externalizing the ticket generation. Like I'm a big believer in automating crash collection. Because as soon as a person wrote the bug report or wrote the ticket item, you can question the person. A generated ticket is one that we're all on the same side of. Why did the machine make this? What is it on about? Anytime when we can all stand together, stare at a screen, and debate You know, what do you think the problem here is, as opposed to why does this exist? You get away from the ad hominem attacks and those kinds of issues much more. And we're all on the same side of the problem. We're trying to figure out what this is and get it resolved. Mm-hmm. So, Tom, what's next for you? I mean, obviously, Stack Overflow is good fun and plenty of work. Are the other books due for an update? Do you have some sessions or conferences you're going to be at soon?
Well, I'll be at SRECON in the Bay Area in California in March, giving a presentation on operational best practices for April Fool's pranks.
Brilliant.
Which it turns out there's a lot of things you need to do. I mean, at our site, we've DDoSed our own site by having April Fool's pranks that backfired on us.
Build a bad prank. So you're speaking from a position of experience.
Yeah, sadly. And it turns out these are all the same techniques that you would need for launching any new feature. So sure. It's very useful. As far as books, I'm not involved in any book projects right now. People keep asking me to update my time management book because it was written before iPhones and still mentions Palm Pilots and PDAs. Wow. But I think the principles are still there, but it's tempting. Maybe in 2019, I might consider updating that. And other writing projects, I now have a column in Q Magazine, which is a publication of the Association for Computing Machines, which most people, if you know about it, you might think of it as the stuffy computer science organization, but Q Magazine is their publication that is for practitioners and a little more down to earth.
Awesome stuff.
I'll give you a link for the show notes.
Yeah, for sure. Tom Limoncelli, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really a pleasure.
It's an honor to be here.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.